He can sit tight until Aziz is done checking the second and third floors, and then he can head back down using the elevator. Kennedy thought about it for a moment and then said, "It sounds reasonable to me." Both Kennedy and Campbell looked up at Flood and Stansfield. General Flood looked at Stansfield first, and then Campbell.
"Tell Commander Harris to get his men ready to move, but they are to wait for my order before they cross the fence line."
Campbell and Kennedy went back to their spots, leaving the two older men alone. Flood moved close to Stansfield and asked,
"How does this change things with the Vice President?"
Stansfield pondered the question momentarily and then replied,
"I'm not sure. He was awfully vague in his direction. He seemed to leave the door open for everything up to the point of an actual raid."
Flood shook his head and muttered, "Vice President Baxter is severely hampered in the leadership department. He is not the person we need for this crisis."
Stansfield slowly nodded.
"He's trying to cover all of his bets."
"So what do we do?"
The director of the CIA thought about it for a moment.
"He was vague for a reason. I almost got the feeling he wanted to be kept out of the loop."
"He wants his deniability." The general was not happy. "Well, screw him and the horse he rode in on. We can tell him in the morning when he gets his lazy ass out of bed."
On the east side of the White House, Lieutenant Commander Harris and his men were busy getting ready. The air under the tarp was soupy. Condensation had formed on the sides of the three vehicles, and rivulets of water were dripping to the ground. Every man was sweating profusely, but they all ignored it. They were used to working in conditions far worse than this. Harris had already chosen his two men. The first was Nick Schultz, a 38-year-old chief petty officer. Schultz was an EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Specialist, who had been on the teams since he was 20. Due to his natural knack for explosives, he had spent a fair amount of time as a basic underwater demolition SEAL instructor for the grueling 26-week course that all candidates must complete before they can become a SEAL. However, what made Schultz one of the very best experts was his steady, unflappable demeanor. The second man Harris had picked was Danny Kraft. The choice was actually a foregone conclusion, since Kraft was Schultz's swim buddy. Kraft was Schultz's junior by 10 years. Where Schultz was calm and introspective, Kraft was active and outgoing. And where Schultz was plain-looking, Kraft was boyishly handsome. Looking quite a bit younger than his 28 years of age, Kraft had used his blue-gray eyes to woo college co-eds on both coasts. There was rarely a free night that the young SEAL spent alone. The two men were polar opposites, and as the older Schultz had expected, this worked to their advantage. Kraft saw things that Schultz didn't, and vice versa. Over the last 2 years, they had honed their skills and become a very effective duo. As they prepared for their insertion, the two men stood side by side in front of a long folding table and checked their equipment one last time. Besides their weapons and specialized toolkits, they were bringing one exceptional piece of equipment. Laid out on the table before them was a mobile X-ray imager made by Safety and Security Instruments out of San Diego. The first two pieces of the unit were the RTR-4 X-ray imager and the XR-200 X-ray source. The two units worked in conjunction with a third piece of equipment, the RTR-4 control unit. This portable Pentium computer was mounted in a super sturdy gasket-sealed aluminum case with shock-mounted components. The active matrix color flat panel display on the control unit would provide Schultz and Kraft with a real-time sneak and peek into the guts of Aziz's bombs. Without the RT-4, any attempt to open the outer casing of the bombs would be a game of Russian roulette. Standing 15 feet away in the open doorway of the CIA communications van, Lieutenant Commander Harris was busy listening to General Campbell and Irene Kennedy back at Langley. Harris was waiting for an opportunity to make his pitch, but hadn't found it. General Campbell was asking a lot of questions, as was Kennedy. When there was finally a pause, Harris made his move.
General Campbell, I'd like to request permission to go in with my demo boys. I think... Campbell cut him off.
Request denied. I want you with your team.
Harris held the handset of the secure field radio to his ear. He was not to be deterred so easily.
I respectfully disagree, sir. I think I would be more valuable helping conduct the recon of the building.
You are to stay put, Commander.
The voice was not Campbell's. It was General Flood's. Harris, slightly caught off guard, had not expected Flood to be listening in on the conversation. The highest-ranking officer in the entire U.S. military continued by saying,
If things proceed well, there's a good chance we'll be sending you and your team in.
Yes, sir, was the only reply Harris could muster.
Now, get your boys moving. Iron Man will be waiting for them on the other side.
Back in the stash room, Mitch Rapp was reorganizing his gear for his incursion back into the bowels of the 200-year-old mansion. Things were happening fast, but he was more than happy to receive the professional services of a couple of SEAL demolition experts, especially since it would mean he would not have to deal with the bombs. One thing he did want to do before he headed out, though, was talk to the woman he had grabbed from the president's bed. Rapp had been so busy talking to Kennedy and the others that he hadn't had the chance to find out who the woman was, and more important, if she had any information that might help them. Moving his gear to the side, Rapp took off his baseball cap and scratched his head. Watching Adams give the woman some water, he noticed for the first time that she was very attractive. Stunning, actually. Rapp scooted forward on his knees to get a little closer and asked,
How are you feeling?
Really had wrapped herself tightly in the sheet and had one arm out. Looking up at the man kneeling in front of her, she replied timidly,
I'm fine.
But before the last syllable left her mouth, the tears started again. Really brushed some of them from her cheek and added,
I'm not fine, I'm a mess.
Rapp laughed at her blunt observation. Reaching out, he grabbed her shoulder and said,
You're fine. Everything's gonna be fine.
Really looked up again, her bottom lip quivering slightly.
I'll never be able to thank you enough for what you did.
Grabbing his hand, she squeezed it and said,
I owe you my life.
Rapp blushed slightly.
Now, there's no need to be melodramatic.
He didn't know how to deal with the unusually personal gratitude of the woman, having grown used to his deeds going unnoticed by all but a select few.
I'm serious.
Really squeezed his hand tighter.
I'm not being melodramatic. You saved my life.
Well, Rapp started uncomfortably, he might not have killed you.
Oh, scoffed Reilly in between sniffles. That's a hell of a consolation.
She started to cry even harder. Milt Adams was still sitting next to Reilly. He looked at Rapp and shook his head.
You need to learn how to accept someone's gratitude, you big oaf. You're welcome. That's what you say to the pretty little woman.
With his hand still on the woman's shoulder, Rapp scowled at Adams. Etiquette was hardly a concern of his at the moment. Rapp turned back to the woman whose moist cheek was now resting on his hand. After squeezing her shoulder lightly, Rapp reached out with his other hand and brushed some of the tears from her cheek.
You're welcome, he started tentatively. I'm glad I was there to help.
Rapp held her cheek for a moment and then lifted her head so he could look her in the eye. That was when he noticed them. The greenest eyes he had ever seen. So beautiful were they that Rapp lost his concentration for a second and forgot what he was about to ask. He blinked several times and then remembered where he was headed.
I need to ask you some questions. Are you up to it?
Reilly nodded and wiped the remaining tears from her cheeks. Taking part of her sheet, she blew her nose quietly and said,
God, I haven't cried this much in years.
Well, you've been through a lot.
Rapp was making a concerted effort to say the right things.
What a shitty couple of days.
Reilly shook her head and managed a laugh.
Yeah, I'd imagine they don't get much worse.
Rapp looked at his watch and said,
Listen, I have some things I have to do, but I want to ask you some questions first.
Reilly nodded.
Good. Let's start with your name.
Anna. Anna Reilly.
I'm Mitch, and this is Milt. Reilly wiped her hand on the sheet and extended it.
Nice to meet you, Mitch.
Reilly gave a warm smile, showing off her dimples.
Very nice to meet you.
Rapp grinned and shook her hand. Reilly then turned to Adams and shook his hand.
What do you do here at the White House? Asked Rapp.
I'm a reporter.
From the look on Rapp's face, one would think they were on their first date and she had just told him she had a husband. Oh, shit, Rapp thought to himself. This could be a problem.
Who do you work for?
NBC. It was my first day on the job.
Nice timing, Rapp said with a raised eyebrow.
No shit,
Reilly shook her head. Where have you been held for the last several days?
In the White House mess.
Rapp looked to Adams, who nodded and said,
That's where I thought he would hold them. No exterior windows, and the room is big enough.
Rapp was worried about whether Aziz had kept all of the hostages together or split them up. As a general rule, that decision depended on assets and the layout of the building. With this in mind, Rapp was inclined to believe that with Aziz's limited manpower, he would be forced to keep all of the hostages in one place.
Were all of the hostages kept in the mess?
Yes, Reilly shrugged her shoulders. At least I think so.
How many of you?
Biting her bottom lip, Reilly thought about it for a moment and said,
I don't know. 80? 100? 120? I don't know.
I really need you to think about this one. You don't have to answer it right now, but I need you to try and remember how many people were in the mess.
Reilly nodded.
I'll try.
What about Secret Service agents? Were they held in the same room as you?
Rapp knew Aziz well enough to bet that he would at the very least separate the Secret Service agents from the hostages.
I don't know. When all this started, I'd only been on the job for about 15 minutes. I don't know what any of the agents look like.
You don't have to know them personally to be able to pick them out. They all have short haircuts, athletic builds. They stand out.
Rapp looked at her proddingly.
Come on, you're a reporter. With a grin, he added, You're supposed to notice stuff like that.
Reilly thought about it.
I don't remember seeing anyone like that.
What about any Marines or other military types? Asked Milt Adams.
Reilly shook her head immediately.
I know for a fact I didn't see anyone in a uniform.
Rapp nodded to Adams, approving of the timely question. That settled it for him. Aziz was either holding the Secret Service and military personnel in a different location, or he had killed all of them. Knowing Aziz, the latter was a distinct possibility.
How many different terrorists did you see?
Reilly closed her eyes for a second.
I think I saw 6 of them. And I'm pretty sure I saw the leader. Some prince something or other. I actually met him on the street on my way in the morning all of this started. He got out of a limo with Russ Piper, the chairman of the DNC. Russ is an old friend of my family.
Reilly paused.
I haven't seen him since this whole thing started. I hope he's all right.
The leader is not a prince, said Rapp. His name is Rafiq Aziz.
Reilly had a spasm of shivers and said,
Well, whoever he is, he's evil. And I don't mean just crazy or goofy, I mean evil. He shot someone in cold blood just because they asked for blankets and food. He just lifted his gun without any warning and shot the man in the head.
That would be Rafiq Aziz, said Rapp somberly.
Then, looking down at his watch, he decided he had better get moving.
Well, Ms. Reilly, we'll have to continue this later. I have to go take care of something.
Please, call me Anna,
Reilly smiled.
All right, Anna. I don't know how long this will take, but I should be back in an hour or less. Milt here will take care of you, so don't worry. I know he doesn't look like much, but don't let that fool you.
Adams looked at Rapp deadpan. Rapp grabbed the small fanny pack for his short excursion and strapped it around his waist. He turned his baseball cap around backward and placed his headset over the top, but after hearing only static interference, he turned off the small radio. Reilly watched him intently as he moved about the room on his knees. When he grabbed his submachine gun and stood, Reilly asked,
Who do you work for, Mitch?
The post office.
Rapp nodded for Adams to get up and then looked back at Reilly. "Anna will have to finish this interview later." With a wink, he added reassuringly, "Keep an eye on Milt for me."
Chapter 27. The search of the second and third floors of the White House had taken almost 25 minutes. The three men worked in unison, one always covering the other two, as they went from room to room checking the closets and under the beds. Aziz had been sure they would find her cowering in one of the closets, but they had not. They descended from the third floor. Aziz, walking in the lead, was thinking. He was thinking about the building and how old it was, how much it bothered him that he couldn't just walk from one building to the other without going outside. If he could just have gotten his hands around the president in his office, he would not have had to spread his people so thin. But Aziz knew if he wanted to get the Americans to meet all of his demands, he would have to extract the cowardly president from the safety of his bunker. And the only way he could do that was if his little thief, his gift from Saddam, was successful in his task. Aziz stopped suddenly and did an about-face. Benghazi and Raghib stopped just short of running into their leader. They were tired and their reaction time dulled. Aziz pointed back down the hall and said,
"Follow me. I have decided there is something we need to check while we are here."
The two men stood aside, and Aziz marched off in the direction from which they had come. As they continued down the staircase to the first basement, Aziz opened the fire door and stepped into the hallway. He stood there for several seconds, looking in both directions, and then he walked back into the staircase and continued down to the second basement. He repeated his actions on this floor, pausing just long enough to look down the hallway. When they reached the third basement, Aziz pointed to the stairwell door and said to Raghib,
"You wait here."
Aziz then marched down the hall with Benghazi. When the corridor ended, the two men turned to the left and continued for another 30 feet. Aziz was immediately surprised by the lack of noise. When he had checked on his little thief some 4 hours earlier, the sound had been pronounced. Slightly alarmed by the change, Aziz brought his assault rifle up to a leveled position. Benghazi, sensing his boss's tension, did the same. The outer door that Mustafa had broken through on the first night was only half open. As Aziz approached, he could see only a portion of the outer room to the president's bunker, and his little thief was not in sight. Aziz walked to the left so he could see the right side of the room. There was still nothing. No sound. No Mustafa. Without stopping, Aziz slid through the partially open door and snapped the muzzle of his MP5 to the left. What he saw upset him instantly. Against the far wall, Mustafa was sitting on the floor, asleep in an upright position, his short arms wrapped around his potbelly, and his mouth open with a stream of drool running down his chin. Aziz took 3 steps and forcefully kicked the man's feet. Mustafa's eyes opened instantly, and Aziz shoved the muzzle of his rifle to within an inch of his face.
"What in the hell are you doing?"
Nervously, he replied,
"I was taking a nap."
"I can see that. Why aren't the drills running?"
"They needed a rest."
The safecracker tried to move farther away from the weapon, but there was nowhere to go.
"If I run them non-stop, they will burn out."
Aziz moved the rifle away from the man's face. The answer had satisfied him for the moment.
"Are you still on schedule?"
"Yes."
Mustafa rolled his plump body onto one knee and stood.
"I am actually several hours ahead of schedule."
Aziz raised an interested eyebrow.
"Really? When do you expect to have the door opened?"
Mustafa looked at his watch.
"If the drills continue to work well, I think I can have the door opened around 7 this evening."
Aziz smiled.
"That would make me very happy."
Slapping the shorter man on the back, Aziz said,
"You have done good work, Mustafa."
"Thank you."
Mustafa bowed his head slightly, accepting the rare compliment. Aziz looked over at the shiny vault door. In less than 24 hours, he would have his hands on the president. Mustafa's news of being ahead of schedule helped assuage Aziz's anger over the loss of Hassan. Once he had the president, he could breathe a sigh of relief. Leaving the stash room was a tense process. The only eyes Rapp had outside the room were the sole surveillance unit he had placed in the president's bedroom. This assured him that it was safe to exit the stash room, but Milt cautioned him that the large closet also had a door at the opposite end that led into the First Lady's bedroom.
"All right," Rapp whispered,
and Adams opened the wall several inches. Not moving, not breathing, Rapp peeked through the crack and listened. Stepping into the closet, he immediately noticed that its door to the First Lady's bedroom was open. Rapp checked to his left and his right twice, and then walked toward the First Lady's bedroom. He stood at the doorframe for a moment and listened. The room was empty. Directly across the room was another door, which was closed. Rapp figured it was either a closet or a bathroom. Whichever the case, it made no difference. The fact that the door he was standing in had been left open and the one across the room had been closed, however, was significant. It meant that Aziz and his men had done a sloppy job on the search. Each door should have been opened, checked, and then closed. Because of this inconsistency, Rapp felt confident enough to close the door to the closet. He quickly rummaged through the closet, grabbing a sweatshirt, a pair of sweatpants, and a pair of white sweat socks. Rapp went back to the stash room door and handed the clothes to Adams.
"Give these to Anna."
Rapp looked at the shelf to his right and saw a blanket and two pillows.
"Here, take these too. Try to get her to sleep."
Rapp began to close the door and said,
"And make sure you don't bolt this thing. If I'm in a hurry to get back in, I don't want to have to stand out here and knock."
Adams nodded and said,
"Good luck."
Rapp closed the organizer tight and silently moved across the president's bedroom. Three steps, and he was across the entrance hall and into the bathroom. Reaching behind a light to the left of the medicine cabinet, he found the button and pressed it. The wall sprang open an inch, and with his gloved hand, Rapp pulled it open several more feet. With the push of another button, the elevator's doors opened, and Rapp began his near silent descent. Seconds later, the elevator stopped and the doors opened. Rapp retraced his earlier steps down the hallway and into the stairs leading to the third basement. When he arrived at the landing door, he reached for the handle and stopped just inches short. The stairwell was darker than the hallway on the other side, and a half inch of bright light bordered the bottom of the door. Rapp had seen something. His eyes had caught some type of motion, a variance in light. Cautiously, Rapp backed up, wondering if the SEALs could already have arrived. With his gun leveled, he kept his eyes trained on the patch of light. After only seconds, he saw the shadow again. Frowning, he opened up the monitor, this time not daring to holster his weapon. With the monitor opened, his gun in his left hand and the snake in his right, he moved to the far side of the door handle and slowly inched the tiny lens forward along the concrete floor. Rapp's eyes went back and forth between watching the screen and watching the progress of the snake. An inch at a time, he nudged it forward. The first thing Rapp saw on the screen was a pair of boots. As he pushed the lens forward, combat fatigues came into view, and then the distinctive barrel, hand grip, and curved magazine of an AK-74. Rapp pulled the snake back deliberately and swore to himself. Why was a bad guy all of a sudden down here in the basement? They had come across no one on the way in. Why now? As Rapp leaned flat against the wall, he tried to make some sense of it. After a while, he decided it must have been the girl. He had to make a decision, and the sooner he made it, the better. Waiting in the stairwell was not an option. There was no cover, and someone could come along at any minute. It was too big a risk. Opening the door and shooting the terrorist was an option, but one that would have to be a last resort. Rapp was left with only one real course: go back and tell Kennedy and Campbell to put the SEALs in a holding pattern until he could make sure the basement was clear. Rapp looked down at the corner where the white concrete wall met the hinges of the door. He reached inside the cargo pocket of his pants and extracted one of the micro video and audio surveillance units. Dropping to a knee, he attached a Velcro patch to the wall and then carefully positioned the unit so the tiny fiber optic lens would have a view under the doorway. Rapp ascended to the second floor of the mansion quickly, taking less than 2 minutes to cover the distance from the third basement. When the small elevator reached the second level, Rapp turned on his monitor and checked the view of the president's bedroom. All was clear on the video and the audio, so he closed the screen and stepped out onto the tile floor of the bathroom. From there, it was across the way and into the large closet once again. With the doors closed, he found the hidden latch for the wall organizer and opened the way to the stash room. Adams and Reilly were sitting wide-eyed on the floor when Rapp entered, and Adams said, "You're back kind of quick, aren't you?" Rapp shook his head while he dropped to his knees in front of the secure field radio. "Yeah, we've got a problem downstairs."
"Like what?"
"We've got a tango running around down in the third basement."
"A what?"
Rapp pressed several buttons on the control panel of the radio. "A tango. A bad guy. A terrorist." Rapp brought the handset up to his ear. With a worried expression, Adams asked,
"Did he see you?"
"If he saw me, Milt, he wouldn't still be walking around." Rapp turned his focus to the radio and said, "Iron Man to control. Over." Rapp had to repeat himself before he got a reply. Kennedy's voice came back clearly. "Iron Man, this is control. We read you. Over."
"We have a problem. There is at least one tango in the third basement. I repeat, one tango in the third basement."
"Where in the third basement?" was General Campbell's question.
2 minutes ago, he was standing just outside the stairwell by the door to the boiler room."
"Any others in sight?"
"Not that I could see, but my only shot was with the snake under the door."
Rapp added earnestly, "My immediate suggestion is to put the brakes on the next two through the chute. It's not worth the risk at this time to bring them into an unsecured area."
"Hold for a second, Iron Man," was Campbell's reply.
While Rapp waited for the brass on the other end to finish their little powwow, he opened up his monitor and attempted to get a feed from the second surveillance unit he had placed in the basement. He was still playing with the unit when Kennedy came back on the line.
"Iron Man, any thoughts on what the tango is doing in the basement?"
"Probably looking for the girl, which means Aziz and Benghazi might also be down there."
There was another period of silence over the line while the brass conferred. Kennedy came back 10 seconds later and said,
"Iron Man, we concur. Stay put while we see if we can slow things down."
"Roger."
Rapp pressed the speaker button and placed the handset back in its cradle. From the tiny speaker on the control panel of the radio, an electronic hum told Rapp the line was still open. Turning his attention back to the monitor strapped to his chest, he went to work trying to get something from the surveillance unit in the basement.
Aziz's spirits had rebounded. The news that he would have his hands around the neck of the president by dusk today had helped temper the loss of the idiot Hassan. If he could just hold out until then, the chances for complete success would double, if not triple. The next 15 or so hours would be the tensest of the siege. Aziz corrected himself on that point. It would be the next 5 hours. Once the sun was up, he would be safe again. But come nightfall, the chances of a strike would increase once again. Aziz had gone to great pains to study the techniques used by the world's elite counter-terrorist strike teams, such as Germany's GSG-9, France's GIGN, Britain's SAS, and of course, America's three premier teams. The groups all shared information on training, strategy, intelligence, and tactics, and competed in annual competitions to help hone each other's skills. All of the groups followed a fairly standard procedure when confronted with a hostage crisis. Initial deployment of assets, intelligence collection, planning, development, and practice of the takedown, mission approval, and finally, execution of takedown. All of the groups were good, and the three U.S. teams were always ranked at or near the top in every category except one. When it came to mission approval, the U.S. teams were consistently ranked at the bottom.
The common critique from the international counterterrorism community was that the U.S. had too many people in the chain of command. Too many people throwing their opinions into the arena and thus slowing down a process that depended on speed and efficiency. This was one of the things Aziz was planning to exploit. This, as well as the American media and ultimately public opinion. The morning would bring a new day in the media cycle, and Aziz would begin to implement another crucial part of his plan. If he succeeded, it would keep the dogs at bay for another day. The politicians were his allies, and he needed to keep them believing there was a way out of the situation. Aziz needed to keep them and their opinions directly involved in the chain of command, because, as long as they stayed involved, the generals would be unable to strike. As Aziz walked down the hall with Benghazi, he started to see one fundamental flaw in his plan. He had succeeded in negating the Americans' manpower advantage through the use of explosives and the exterior surveillance cameras he had seized from the Secret Service. With the amount of explosives he had deployed, any attack would result in the deaths of all the rescuers and, if need be, the hostages too. The flaw, Aziz was now sure, was created once again by the separation of the West Wing and the Executive Mansion. The West Wing was 100% secured, but the mansion was not. If the Americans found out that he was in the process of extracting the president from his bunker, there was no telling what they might do. It was entirely likely that they would risk everything to prevent the president from falling into his hands. As Aziz and Benghazi neared the end of the hall, Aziz stopped and said, "Muammar, I want you to stay here for the rest of the night. I will send you a replacement at," Aziz looked at his watch, 7. "I want you to make sure that nothing happens to my little ferret." Aziz pointed in the direction of the bunker. "If you fail me this time, you will be begging for a quick death." The subordinate nodded while maintaining his ramrod posture. Aziz turned to go back upstairs and was confronted by two doors, one of them he had not noticed before. Turning to Benghazi, he asked, "Where does this lead?"
"To the boiler room," the heavily bearded Benghazi answered.
"Boiler room," Aziz repeated while he mulled over the words. "Was it secured after we took over?"
"Yes," stated Benghazi. "I checked it personally."
Aziz stood looking at the doorway, thinking for a long moment. "Do you remember," he asked Benghazi, "the incident at the Indonesian consulate in Amsterdam, back in the 70s? Benghazi's face twisted as he tried to jog his memory. After a while, he replied,
"Yes, I remember what happened. The terrorists surrendered after a long standoff with the police."
2 weeks, answered Aziz, referring to how long the siege had lasted. "Did you know that during the standoff, the CIA assisted the Dutch government by getting one of their people into the building via the sewer pipe?"
"No."
"Neither did the terrorists. The man came in through the basement and bugged the building. Everything the terrorists said and did was heard by the Dutch authorities." Aziz looked back at the door. "When was the last time you checked this room?"
"I checked it yesterday afternoon."
"A lot has happened since then. I think we should check it again." Without waiting for Benghazi's opinion, Aziz started for the door. The two SEALs trudged forward through the ventilation duct in complete darkness, Kraft in the lead and Schultz close behind. This is what they had trained their whole lives to do. There wasn't a special forces operator in the service worth his salt who wouldn't have given his left nut to be in their position. All the push-ups, early morning runs, icy swims, hour upon hour of target practice, live fire drills, parachute jumps that ran into the triple digits, it all came down to this. Apprehension was a word that didn't belong in their vocabulary. Maybe caution from time to time, but not apprehension. These men relished the task before them and knew all too well what the stakes were. Death was a distinct possibility. They had seen team members die in both training and covert operations. That was the life they had decided to live, and there wasn't a day they regretted the decision. The younger Kraft was in the lead because he had asked to be. The two SEALs were now experiencing the same problem that Rapp and Adams had. The closer they got to the White House, the worse their radio reception became. Like the two that had gone before them, they had removed their earpieces after a while because the static became so bad. It had not occurred to anyone, either at Langley or at SEAL Team 6's mobile command post, to have Schultz and Kraft string along a phone line, a military practice that had been commonplace for almost a century, but had gone by the wayside with the recent onslaught of high-tech radios and billion-dollar satellites. Events had progressed too quickly, and a low-tech solution to a critical battlefield problem had been missed. Kraft was glad he had remembered to put on his elbow and knee pads before being lowered into the ventilation duct. He had about 30 pounds of gear on his body and was pulling another 30 behind him via a rope. Wiggling like a reptile, he could move only 4 to 6 inches at a time, and his elbows were doing most of the work. The two men moved quietly for the most part, the only real noise coming from the equipment they dragged behind them. The noise wasn't much, no more than that of a shirt sliding down a clothes chute. It was hard to tell how far they had gone, but to Kraft it seemed as if they were nearing the end. He stopped momentarily and looked behind him. All he found was more blackness and the sounds of his swim buddies squirming his way forward. Kraft decided to shed some light on the situation. Turning onto one side, he extracted his pistol, a Heckler & Koch USP-45 ACP. Attached to the pistol was both a cylindrical suppressor and a laser aiming module. Kraft turned on the laser, and the red dot bounced off the walls of the duct. Aiming the pistol straight ahead, Kraft found the end of the shaft not more than 30 feet away. Aziz placed his hand on the doorknob and nodded to Benghazi. Benghazi took up a position opposite Aziz and signaled that he was ready. When Aziz opened the door, Benghazi swung his rifle and half of his body into the now open space. Benghazi looked down at the expansive room from a slightly elevated position. A small grated metal landing was just on the other side of the door, and 3 steps led from the landing down to the stark concrete floor of the boiler room. One dim light off to the left provided minimal lighting. After Benghazi looked from one side of the room to the other, he checked on both sides of the door frame for more light switches. After coming up empty, he spotted a group of 4 switches at the bottom of the grated steps. Benghazi moved down the steps and slapped all 4 switches up with the palm of his hand. The room lit up with powerful overhead lamps. Aziz stepped onto the landing and surveyed the room, his MP5 gripped in both hands. He nodded for Benghazi to move out ahead while he slowly came down the steps. Neither man spoke. Benghazi had known Aziz long enough to recognize when he was spooked. Aziz did not know exactly what he was looking for. As he peered around the room, he wondered if he wasn't being overly paranoid. There had been very little time for sleep over the last week, and his nerves were getting raw. The truth, however, was that it is impossible to be too paranoid when dealing with the CIA. He should have thought of this possibility earlier, but so much had changed from the original plan. It was a grave oversight on his part. He had been thinking of too many things and spreading himself too thin, but he was focused now. Nothing mattered more than getting his hands on the president, and if that meant sacrificing some of his assets to secure this area of the basement, it was a gamble that was well worth it. As Aziz moved across the room, a good 10 paces behind Benghazi, his eyes searched the floor for any type of drain, grate, or pipe. While he looked, he wondered how big the sewer pipe must have been in Amsterdam. Not any pipe would do. It would have to be big, and he doubted that anything big enough to support a human would be running into the White House. Aziz was looking under one of the large boilers when he heard a soft whistle from Benghazi. Standing up straight, he looked over to his man who was standing with 1 finger over his lips and the barrel of his rifle pointing up. Aziz stood with his neck craned upward, watching the metal duct that ran from the wall diagonally across the room to some large piece of equipment. Listening intently, he focused everything on the duct. After a short while, he thought he saw something. A glimmer off the lights, a buckle in the metal. Aziz's brow furrowed. Again, he saw something, some type of movement. Aziz stepped from his cover to get a closer look. Some 20 feet away, Benghazi shook his head at him and tried to wave him back. Aziz ignored him and continued to approach the duct. Finally, when he was directly under the structure, he heard the noise. It sounded like a rat moving behind the walls of an old building. Something was definitely in the duct. Aziz looked behind him and took several steps back, putting himself in direct line with the length of the duct. Then, raising his MP5, he sighted in on part of the duct that protruded from the wall. With the butt of the rifle squeezed tightly between his right shoulder and cheek, he depressed the trigger and unleashed a volley of automatic fire, the heavy rounds slicing through the thin metal with ease. 9 rounds were fired in total, the noise from the shots careening off the concrete floors and walls, leaving the ears of Aziz and Benghazi ringing. The smell of spent rounds filled the air, and a cluster of shell casings rolled aimlessly about the floor near Aziz's feet. Aziz did not move. He stood his ground with his rifle still pointed at the duct, his eyes fixed on the straight line of bullet holes he had just laced into the thin metal. At first, there was nothing. No movement and no noise other than the ringing of the shots that had been fired, and then, out of one of the holes, something dark beaded into a droplet, and after an eternity, it broke free. Both Aziz and Benghazi watched it fall to the ground. The drop hit the gray concrete floor and splashed into a spidered crimson pattern. Without hesitation, both Aziz and Benghazi stepped back and opened up on the duct with a relentless hail of bullets. Chapter 28. The apartment was nice. It had been decorated by his mother. She had insisted on flying to D.C. to help her son get settled in. Now that Dallas was an important figure in Washington, he'd have to entertain. Mrs. King had loaded up her son with the best that Williams-Sonoma Pottery Barn and Restoration Hardware could provide. The two-bedroom apartment in Adams Morgan cost him $1,900 a month, but it was worth it. It was only a couple of blocks away from some of Washington's best night spots. There were plenty of women around, and it was close to work. Dallas King sat at the breakfast bar in the kitchen with a cup of coffee in one hand and the remote control to his TV in the other. He was waiting for the 7 a.m. top-of-the-hour CNN news update. Dallas took a sip of coffee and looked down the hall to his bedroom. Through the cracked door, he glimpsed the lean leg of his lovely little Asian hostess, Kim. She had been everything he had hoped, and then some. After King finished his meeting with Sheila Dunn, he had moved to the bar for one more glass of wine. Someone must have explained to the hostess who he was, because she began asking him questions about the crisis. King worked it for everything it was worth, stressing his role as Vice President Baxter's closest advisor, complaining about the pressure, and finally telling her how much he wanted to be with her. By the time 1 a.m. rolled around, he had her punched out and on the way to his apartment. As he sipped his coffee, CNN came back from a commercial break. King turned up the volume and listened to the anchor start off with the lead story of the morning. Footage of a candlelight vigil that had taken place the night before flashed across the screen. The anchor announced that an estimated 50,000 people had taken part in the silent march from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. Next came more footage of massive crowds pressing against police barricades in an effort to glimpse the White House. This relatively calm footage was replaced by images of protesters burning American flags in Gaza, the West Bank, Baghdad, and Damascus. King shook his head and muttered,
If they keep that shit up, we'll have no choice but to storm the place.
The anchor and the correspondent talked for almost a minute about the official reactions of governments around the Middle East and then broke away for a live briefing being delivered by Director Roach of the FBI. Roach stood in front of a Justice Department podium and started out reading from prepared text. The director gestured to an easel on his left, saying,
"This is the photo we released yesterday of Mohammed Batiki, the man we believe to have fired shots from the roof of the Washington Hotel during the opening moments of the attack on the White House. We now know his real name to be Salim Roussan. He is at large and considered to be extremely dangerous. Right now we are offering a $1 million reward for any information leading to the arrest of Roussan and a second individual." One of Roach's aides removed the first photo and replaced it with a second of a man wearing a green uniform. His hair was slicked back, and he had a gold chain with a cross hanging from his open collar.
"This man worked for the White Knight Linen Service Company," Roach continued, "and went by the name of Vinnie Vitelli. His real name is Abu Hassan. We are not sure if he is at large, but we are very interested in talking to anyone who has dealt with him in the last year."
Roach continued to talk, giving a number to call, but King wasn't listening. His eyes were open wide in disbelief. It couldn't be. King stood, almost dropping his coffee cup. Tugging at the collar of his white bathrobe, he raced for the TV.
"Oh my God, it's him!"
No one in the bunker had slept for more than a half hour at a time, and some of the agents had not slept at all. The noise of steel assaulting steel grew louder as morning approached. President Hayes remained confident that the FBI would come. He'd been through the briefings. He had listened to the experts state that the best time to attack was right before dawn. It was when people were most sluggish, and hence easiest to surprise. It started to brighten, this time of the year, around 5:30, and the sun was up by a quarter past 6. Each of the 11 felt a fevered anticipation as morning drew near, but as the hours passed by, there was collective letdown followed by depression, as the nerve-wracking sound of the door being breached gnawed at their ears. Each individual, including the president, asked himself or herself the same question over and over again. Can we hold out for another day? Valerie Jones was coming back from the small bathroom where she had finally, after 2 days, decided to remove the makeup from her face. Considering the situation, she felt that any hang-ups about her wrinkles and the dark circles under her eyes were foolish. Jones had spent all night thinking about the president's rebuke the day before. She had worked far too hard to get where she was, and she wouldn't allow anyone to pin the blame on her for admitting a terrorist into the Oval Office. In Jones's mind, the truth was never that simple. There were always 8 sides to every story. There was no way she was going to roll over now and watch her career go up in flames. Jones had been concentrating on angles all night. Who could influence Hayes to help put the story in the proper light? Whom could she use to focus Hayes's anger on? The first question was easy to answer. Jones knew enough senators and big donors. She could get them to whisper in the president's ear, or, if needed, lean on him. The way she would spin it would be to hold up Russ Piper and the DNC as sacrificial lambs. All Jones did was put him and his guest down in the appointment book. That menial task was hardly worth ending someone's career over. As far as getting her boss to focus his anger on something or someone else, Jones was working on that. She proceeded back to the couches and sat next to him. If she could get him thinking in another direction, she just might hold on to her job and her career. President Hayes didn't bother to look up when his chief of staff sat. Jones studied him for a second and then asked,
"Why wouldn't they have come?"
Hayes shook his head.
"I don't know. They must have a good reason."
"Like what? Isn't it our policy not to negotiate with terrorists?"
Hayes glanced over at her.
"We don't always stick to policy."
"Well, who's making the decisions?"
The president looked at her with his tired eyes.
As I told you yesterday, if they're following the Constitution, which I'm sure they are, the powers of the presidency will have been transferred to Vice President Baxter. Jones rolled her eyes.
That isn't good news.
The president did nothing at first and then nodded slowly in agreement.
Why wouldn't he send in the FBI?
I don't know, Valerie. Hayes sounded very impatient. The tension and lack of sleep were working on his nerves.
Well, it makes no sense.
Jones moved forward cautiously.
Everything you said about the FBI striking before sunrise made sense. I don't understand why they wouldn't have come.
There's a lot we don't know about. They could have plenty of good reasons why they're waiting to attack. Jones was keenly aware of the problems between President Hayes and Vice President Baxter. She and the president had discussed them on many occasions. If she could get the president to focus his anger on Baxter, her minor role in this debacle would be forgotten. In a voice just barely above a mumble, Jones planted the seed that she hoped would shift the president's righteous ire in a different direction.
Or Baxter likes being president.
Irene Kennedy stood in her office and watched the sun rise over the trees of the Potomac River Valley. Any attempt to count her hours of sleep over the last week would be a wasted exercise. They were too few and too far between. She had more pressing things on her mind, and besides, thinking of sleep only caused her to worry more about Rapp. Kennedy had been hoping to steal a couple of hours on the couch in her office after the two SEALs had made it into the White House and reported back on the bombs, but that never happened. Things had fallen apart, and they had done so miserably. At 2:23 a.m., Kennedy had been sitting in the control room at Langley when an irate Skip McMahon called. McMahon had been rousted from his cot in the executive office building just minutes earlier by Rafik Aziz. He had stumbled down the hall and into the FBI's command post in his boxers and T-shirt. Once on the phone, McMahon was further confused by the wild accusations Aziz had flung at him. Everything Aziz said came up empty with McMahon. McMahon tried in vain to deny the accusations, but Aziz only grew more irritated. As Aziz began to threaten to kill hostages, McMahon began to link the recent events with a phone call he had received from FBI Director Roach the previous evening. Roach had explained to McMahon that the CIA would be moving some sensitive surveillance equipment into position by the east fence of the White House. In less than a minute, one of McMahon's agents had a set of blueprints rolled out on the table before him and was stabbing his finger at the location of a ventilation duct on the south lawn. As things fell into place, McMahon assured Aziz that he would get to the bottom of the thing within 5 minutes. McMahon's next phone call was to his colleague and good friend Irene Kennedy. That was when the control room at Langley started to piece together what had happened. Upon receiving McMahon's call, General Campbell ordered Harris to send one of his men into the shaft to find out what was going on. Not long after that, the two SEALs were pulled out of the shaft by an electric winch. Nick Schultz had fulfilled the SEAL code of honor by never leaving a man behind in battle, dead or alive. When the shooting started, Schultz was trailing just far enough behind to be safe from the shots, but within reach of the gear that Kraft was pulling behind him by rope. Struggling, he pulled his swim buddy back through the narrow confines of the duct inch by inch, praying his friend would be alive when they reached the other end. It was all for naught. Kraft was dead. Now, standing at the window of her seventh-floor office at Langley and watching the sun climb into the morning sky, Kennedy wished she could turn back the clock and do it all over again. Do it right. Do it the way she had wanted to from the start. Kennedy had promised herself when she got into this business of ordering men into harm's way that she would do everything possible not to become a detached bureaucrat. 17 men had died under her watch at Langley, the majority of them in one seriously botched operation. Kraft would bring the total up to 18, and as with those before him, Kennedy would visit his grave. A knock on the door pulled Kennedy from her trance, and without turning she said, "Come in."
The door opened and closed, but whoever had just entered had chosen to stay silent until recognized. Kennedy finally turned and saw a far-from-jovial Skip McMahon standing across from her.
"Skip, I couldn't say anything to you last night. There were far too many people around."
McMahon, dressed in a suit and tie, stared her down, his hands on his hips and deep, dark circles under his eyes.
"I can't believe you didn't tell me. I'm sorry."
McMahon shook his head slowly from side to side.
"You and I have never played these games. We've always been straight up with each other."
"I know. I apologize. It's just that things happened too fast last night. I wanted to tell you. I asked if I could bring you in on it, and I was told to wait."
"By who, Thomas?"
"It goes higher than that."
McMahon frowned skeptically.
"How much higher?"
Kennedy turned away, not entirely comfortable with telling McMahon. McMahon reached out and grabbed Kennedy's chin, forcing her to look him in the eye.
"No more games. I want the truth."
Kennedy reached up and pulled his hand down.
"You have to keep it to yourself."
"The hell I do," snapped McMahon.
"Don't talk to me like that," chided Kennedy while taking a step back. "We're friends."
"Well, friends don't let friends get ambushed by hanging them out to dry."
"Skip, this came down from above. I wanted to tell you, but I couldn't. And I didn't have enough time to convince them otherwise."
"Who authorized those men to go in, and who decided to shut the FBI out of it?"
Kennedy sighed and said,
"Vice President Baxter."
"That motherfucker!"
McMahon wheeled away from Kennedy, his fists balled up in anger.
"That arrogant motherfucker! Where in the hell does he get off?"
McMahon stopped short of finishing the sentence and strained to regain some composure. Through clenched teeth, he said,
"This is an FBI operation, not the CIA and not the Pentagon. If I am not briefed fully and truthfully by you people, I will march right over to..."
McMahon was cut off by the intercom on Kennedy's desk. "Dr. Kennedy." Kennedy walked over to her desk and pressed the button.
"Yes."
"They are waiting for you in the director's conference room." Kennedy looked at her watch. It was several minutes past 7.
"We'll be right there."
She looked up at McMahon and said,
"We have to get going. But I want you to promise me you'll keep this to yourself until I have a chance to explain further."
Shaking his head, McMahon frowned and said,
"Nope, I'm gonna go in there and chew some ass."
Kennedy reached out and grabbed his wrist firmly.
"No, you are not. There is a lot more, Skip. And if you want to know what is really going on, you keep quiet until the meeting is over."
They were the last two to enter Director Stansfield's private conference room. As Kennedy and McMahon took their seats, an agitated Director Roach was already letting the others know how the FBI felt about the current situation. Horse shit was the phrase he used to describe the mess the others had created and the lack of professional courtesy they had displayed. Seated at the head of the table was Director Stansfield. To his left were Vice President Baxter and Dallas King. To the director's right sat General Flood and Director Roach. McMahon and Kennedy took seats next to each other on Director Roach's side of the table. It was a small meeting, and intended to be so. FBI Director Roach had paused for a brief moment when Kennedy and McMahon entered, and then continued, saying,
"I can see no valid reason for not informing us that you were sending those men into the building. It absolutely mystifies me."
Roach shook his head.
"Skip and I have already talked about it. We would have agreed with sending them in. I just don't get it."
Vice President Baxter leaned forward and stabbed his index finger into the tabletop. Staring at General Flood, he started angrily,
"I did not authorize sending any SEALs through that air duct."
Flood looked back at Baxter with barely masked contempt and then turned to Roach.
"It's my fault. I was given the authority to conduct surveillance, and we were presented with a unique opportunity."
"I still don't see why you couldn't pick up the phone and call us,"
said Roach. Flood sat up a little straighter. He wanted to tell the director of the FBI that he was left out of the loop because the vice president had suggested